Hey, everybody. Welcome to an Alan Smithy podcast. My name is Matt, and I write at cinemachine.blogspot.com.
And I'm Andrew, and I write at thestopbutton.com.
And this is our podcast where we talk about one good movie and one bad movie for 1 hour, give or take. And our good movie this week is Gosford Park by Robert Altman from 2001. And our bad movie is Piranha 2, The Spawning, directed by the James Cameron in 1981. So we're going to talk about Gosford Park first, and I hadn't seen this one before, even though it was, probably the most popular movie Robert Altman had before he died, because after this it was just like what The Company, and then the radio movie, and then he died.
Yeah.
And this one was nominated for Best Picture, and I haven't seen A Beautiful Mind, but I refuse to believe that A Beautiful Mind could have been a better movie than this in 2001. Not that 2001 wasn't an incredible year for film, but amongst the five movies nominated for Best Picture at the Oscars that year, it's kind of ridiculous that A Beautiful Mind would have won over this, and I say that not having seen A Beautiful Mind, but... I've seen other Altman movies, and I don't like all of them, but I love Altman in general. And this one was one of the ones that I liked, and it's kind of hard for me not to like it because it's a very if I didn't know that Robert Altman had directed it, I wouldn't necessarily have known that Altman directed it, even with kind of his trademarks of. Lots of overlapping dialogue, big cast of characters. The way he shot it was like by miking the actors and kind of having more than one camera going so that none of them could really play for the camera. He kind of shot it in a verite way that way. But I guess auteur theorists would say that this is, just like MASH was Altman's spin on the war movie or The Long Goodbye was his spin on a detective noir Philip Marlowe type movie. This was his spin on a murder mystery, and a very British murder mystery, Ali Agatha Christie. And basically the subversion is that it's 2 hours and 15 minutes or so, and the murder doesn't happen until almost exactly halfway through, and there's no indication. He shows you bottles of poison, and he lets his camera linger on knives and stuff. That's another little Altman trademark, is the way Altman shoots props, the way they're almost as if they're actors. But there's no real indication as to like who is even going to be murdered. So, and then when it happens, there's an inspector who shows up, played by Stephen Fry, and like he's not even an issue. Like he doesn't solve the murder, and he's almost a peripheral character. Whereas if this were Agatha Christie and Monsieur Hulot or whatever, the inspector would have showed up 15 minutes in and have been the main character. But I guess you could say it's a murder mystery where the murder doesn't matter, and there isn't really a way to play detective yourself as the viewer. It just kind of has to be explained to you. In other words, the murder mystery is not the point of the movie. It's a series of character studies of these effete snobs and their house guests and the kind of subterranean lives of their servants, who there's just as many servants at least as there are residents and guests of this place, of this mansion where this party's happening. And it kind of explores the dichotomy between them. And there's spoilers obviously, just in case you don't know, but the fact that the murderer is one of the servants is kind of a, I wouldn't say post. I mean, they do sort of make a postmodern nod to the idea that it's always the butler who did it. Ha ha. Somebody even says that. But what's sort of the most clever thing about it is that because the murder was done by one of the servants, he doesn't get caught, and it's only his status as like an invisible servant that lets him get away with it. And in fact, some of the other servants are complicit in it. The main sort of servant who we follow, the Maddie girl, that's her character's name. She finds out about it, but she doesn't reveal it. So it sort of made me think of about the cliche of the butler did it, and it's always the butler who did it. And like, I guess, you know, when murders did happen in Victorian times, or all the way up to the time between World War I and World War II in England, you know, basically the last days of disco for the British Empire. Maybe it was always the butler who did it in real life, because that's probably the person most likely to get away with it. I mean, I don't think your fellow servants and valets weren't as likely to turn you in, because what did they have to gain from it? I don't know. That's kind of a conjecture, but you know, it's postmodern in all those ways. And I think the only way that it's sort of postmodern but didn't really follow up on it is that Bob Balaban, who was like the only actor I knew aside from Helen Mirren, Bob Balaban is in it as a visiting American director, and he just happens to be working on a Charlie Chan murder mystery set in London. And he even says, oh, it's about a murder at an English, you know, mansion. All the guests are suspects. And then, I mean, you know, that's, you know, oh, very clever, you know, ha ha. But what's sort of odd about the way they don't follow up on it is that, like, you don't even see Bob Balaban's character's reaction to the fact that a murder has happened in this setting where he has actually gone to do research for a movie about that very thing. And nobody even comments on it like, oh, isn't it a coincidence that, you know, you're studying us for your murder mystery movie, and here a murder mystery has happened. But Bob Balaban also has story credit. Well, not story credit. He gets a based on an idea by credit along with Altman. And I wish I knew how much of that idea actually came from the two of them, because was it only so much as like, hey, we should do our take on a Agatha Christie murder mystery. We should have a murder at an English mansion party and make a movie like that. Or did they actually, how much of the plot did they come up with? You can't really tell, because it says based on an idea by, and it's the two of them, and then I think, yeah, just the two of them? Well, anyways, it's the two of them, maybe one more person, and then the screenplay credit goes to someone else. And the screenwriter actually did win an Oscar for the best original screenplay. But yeah, those were my first impressions. Was this the second time
this
you saw it?
This is the second time. So I actually didn't remember who did it and how that all worked out. Because basically, spoiler alert, the way it's, I mean, yes, it's like an Agatha Christie because there are lots of characters and therefore lots of suspects, except, you know, since the murder doesn't take place until at least halfway through, nobody's a suspect yet, and they do spend some time establishing who the four suspects are, but only two of them have motives we might know about, and those are the lords and contemporaries of the victim, who's the host of this party. And it's like, in Agatha Christie, they spend a lot of time demonizing everybody. Well, the victim in this doesn't get demonized until after he's dead. I mean, after he's dead, you find out what a complete bastard he was to everyone. It's actually really complicated because, you know, right before the night he dies, you know, there's this, I mean, the movie's 2 hours and 17 minutes long, I think, and it's just this really interesting split between the servants and their ladies. And
yeah, I liked how in the opening credits the servants are paired with the names of the of their lords and ladies, yeah. The actors.
And so, but the murder that occurs takes place for a very Agatha Christie-like, the past coming back, catching up with you type reason, which kind of isn't expected almost. Because Altman, I think, he's done other murder mysteries before. I mean, Long Goodbyes, it's a mystery.
Yeah, but I think all of them have kind of been anti-mysteries.
Because, I mean, this one, Gosford Park is more a... Just the way that the house is split. There's this enormous basement, and there's always the servants, the visiting servants, can't find their way around these passages and things like that. And it's kind of like a... it's the behind the scenes of an old 30s... society picture, in a way. And I mean, they have Jeremy Northam playing Ivor Novello, who was an actor at the time. Or actually, I think he was on his way out, and I think he was more of a silent star, which is why, right, I thought him singing was funny, because, you know, who ever heard him sing? And I think that that's a complete fabrication. I don't think he had any relation to society, but maybe I'm wrong. There was some other movie around the same time as Gosford Park that had a real person in it, and it was a totally fictionalized account. But, you know, so most of the movie is spent seeing how these people are sort of kept functioning by their servants. And I don't think there's a single, you know, except the only nice person who is upstairs, so to speak, is the common wife of one of the guests, who everyone...
Yeah, poor Mrs. Nesbitt, the common wife.
The common wife who's mocked by everyone. And then, I mean, Bob Balaban and Jeremy Northam, they're okay, but one of them's an American, the other one's a film actor, so, you know, they don't really fit in there,
yeah,
either. But everybody else is kind of just... another shade of awful.
And they've brought with them Ryan Felipe, who you know, is pretending to be a servant as research for a role, and then and he's an asshole anyways. He tries to force himself upon Maddie, the servant, and and then he gets his comeuppance when he's revealed for who he is, and the other servants get to be a dick to him with impunity, in a way.
Yeah, and that was the funny thing, is that was one of the other things I didn't remember, and I don't think he actually did the whole I'm going to pretend to be British in British movies thing. So, like, you know, like the male version of Gwyneth Paltrow at that era. And so he comes out and he's got this terrible accent. This terrible Scottish accent. I'm like, what the hell is going on with this? And finally, he's revealed to not actually be Scottish. And what's kind of,
yeah, he's not even a real servant. He's not even Scottish.
So it's just his whole arc is very.
It's kind of one more aspect to the theme of appearances and who these people are or aren't.
He starts a lot more sympathetic than he ends in a lot of ways.
Yeah, that's true. At first he's kind of sympathetic because he doesn't, you know, he doesn't know how to play by all these social protocols, and the other servants, the kind of snobbier servants, including like the head servant of the house, is, you know, takes a particular dislike to him. And since the movie is a lot about disliking snobs, you tend to like him a bit. But then fairly early on in, he tries to force himself on Kelly MacDonald,
yeah,
and then you know that he's a jerk.
And he actually gets multiple comeuppances through the movie, if you think about it, because when Emily Watson,
that's right,
yeah,
she turns him down. She's the head maid.
So there is Let's see. I'm trying to think of how to... I mean, so much of it is the minutia of... It's kind of like Altman took this idea of having a murder mystery, a sensational murder mystery. And I mean, even the way the guy's murdered is pretty interesting. I mean, you know, he's poisoned, then stabbed. So
right, so there may have been two murderers, and there were.
And so, the way he—I mean, it's just—it's very clear. With the exception of, say, the lingering shots on poison and that sort of thing, he's not as much interested in the murder aspect of the movie as he is as using it as a vehicle to sort of getting the characters to their sort of ending point. And the movie does have an arc. It does reunite two estranged sisters who have been estranged for 31 years. And they introduce that point in the last quarter of the movie. I mean, it's always been present, but it's only revealed. I mean, it's more of a revelation than the murder, almost. And so it's just, it's kind of like Altman doing one of his big sprawling movies, but still having a sort of familiar narrative arc to it. And every time an Altman movie starts now, I always wonder, because I mean, he hated, I think we've already talked about it, you don't like The Player.
No.
And he hated The Player. And so every time I start an Altman movie now, I always wonder if it's one of the movies that he liked that he made, or one of the movies that he hated that he made. And it's like, how do you
probably just, he probably only hated The Player because it was praised by the people whom it was intended to mock. But that's another story.
Yeah, and I mean, so Gosford Park, it opens with this, it almost looks like more of a Steadicam shot. But it could have been a crane, I suppose.
I think I read in the trivia on IMDb that every shot in the movie moves around. There's no still shots.
So it opens on, you know, it's just gradual and quiet, and it establishes Kelly MacDonald as the sort of protagonist. Because everything, you know, she is new to being a servant, and she sort of sees everything and sees through fresh eyes. And
she's privy to who the two murderers were at the end.
In fact, she's the only one who figures it out.
Right.
And the funny thing about the sort of investigation is at that point, Gosford Park goes from sort of this social drama to this absurdist comedy. Just by introducing Stephen Fry's idiotic detective. And I'd forgotten, you know, the conclusion. So I'm like, so is he just an idiot and then he really is going to turn out to be smart? Like, how do they, you know, do they catch anybody? How does this?
Yeah, it's almost like too broad for the rest of the movie, because there's this hilarious shot where he's questioning Kelly MacDonald's, you know, lady. In the questioning room where the murder happened, and in the background, his assistant is noticing clues, and he's saying, "Hey, you should look at this." And he's like, "Not now, I'm busy," waving him off, like as waving him off as he discovers a secret passage in the background, and it's like it's like Inspector Clouseau level.
And Altman manages to sort of even earn some sympathy for the poor guy, because the snobs are just so terrible to him. They won't even let him introduce himself. You know, it's when he arrives at the scene, they just want to go to bed after their host has been murdered. And there's so many. So besides the two sisters who've been estranged for 30 years, the host and hostess. Well, I don't think Kristin Scott Thomas is ever in love with anybody else or anything, but it's pretty clear that the, because for the first half, Michael Gambone's host is a relatively sympathetic character. You only learn that he's a complete and utter bastard and deserved everything he got after he's been killed. Apparently, he was in love with his sister-in-law, and they cut cards for him, and it's just this, you know, sort of tragic story of this guy, and the wife hates him because he, you know, made money or something. And then it's just all this sort of angst that we discover all this stuff about the characters from the servants gossiping about them, which is, and I also think it's funny that Altman, how Altman, and I guess Fellows, the guy who wrote it, Julian Fellows and Balaban, how they picked who was going to get off okay at the end of the movie. Because Emily Watson's maid who gets fired ends up going off, presumably, to a future in Hollywood.
Right, because Bob Balaban gives her a lift.
Right, I mean, that's her happy ending. However, this tortured girl, the daughter of the victim, who's spent the entire movie miserable, you know, this guy's been trying to propose to her the entire movie, and he doesn't do it. He leaves her. And she's just going to be miserable forever now. And it's just kind of like, wow. And so, I mean, it's there's a certain amount of black humor
I think. Yeah, there is. Although with the exception of Mrs. Nesbitt, I think everyone pretty much gets what's coming to them. Good people and bad people alike. I mean, just the fact that Ryan Felipe gets to be tortured by the servants and not be able to do anything about it is a little taste of comeuppance.
And I mean, the other interesting thing about that is it's not like he's embraced by the snobs either, because he was a servant for 3 days.
Yeah.
So.
And there's also something to the way Kelly MacDonald gets to walk away with the knowledge, and there's that kind of odd, you know, multi-layered thing where she's talking to her lady at the end of the movie, and it's Maggie Smith, right?
Yeah, Maggie Smith.
Maggie Smith is saying that, you know, wouldn't it be terrible to say something during a trial that could lead to someone being hung, and Kelly MacDonald's just sort of like, yes it is, but she's not going to let the guy who's really good, the servant who was one of the murderers, get hung, because the person who got murdered was a bastard who deserved it, so he gets to have his revenge and eat it too.
And that's kind of also interesting that the murderer gets away with it. It's kind of like there's no morals clause to this one.
Well, but in this case, it's like the murderer, the victim deserved it, and the murderer was getting some kind of justified revenge. It's not like the player.
Right, but I think as the old morals clause worked, he still would have to have been punished.
Are we talking Hayes Code here?
Yeah. And just the general
during the era when more of these types of movies were made.
And yeah, I mean, it's like, even when you think of the big sort of society movies, the maids, the servants are not a big deal. I mean, Balaban's on the phone, and I think that, yeah, I mean, his phone conversations occasionally are very postmodern when he's talking about, you know, in the movies, there's a butler, and he's like, well, yes, there's only one butler, but there are just, you know, countless valets. You know,
yeah, and when
everywhere.
he says, like, no, the servants don't talk. Like, they don't say anything. They just do things. You know, pointing out the gulf between reality and the movies.
And there's also, I mean, there's a lot of time spent on the sort of situation of being a servant that they bring up sometimes dramatically, sometimes just in conversation. But it's, I mean, there really isn't any sympathy for the snobs whatsoever. And
no.
Even though I think you could say that some of the, well, I guess the little guy who was eating jam and his business proposition fell apart, who discovered that he still had his wife, even if they were in financial ruin. Oh, wait, they aren't in financial ruin because the guy got killed. So he should be happy anyway. So I guess he kind of, that's kind of happy, whatever. And then other than that.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, Bob Balaban and Ivor Novello are sympathetic because they recognize that the snobs are snobs too. They have a little aside at the piano where it's like, how do you put up with these people? And Ivor Novello says, I make my living imitating them.
Yeah. And I mean, that's kind of the, another postmodern, having an actor there is sort of very...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the conversations, like, you know, when Germany Northam is talking to Maggie Smith and he's saying, and Maggie Smith is doing the very English passive-aggressive thing of, oh, it must be terrible when one of your movies bombs. You know, how do you put up with that? And how long do you intend to be an actor?
And yeah, I mean, I think Novello was sort of at the end of his career at this point too, like 1932. Yeah. So, and then I'm just trying to think. I mean, it's kind of sort. It's not fast paced, but it's so gradually paced that it's sort of just you sort of ease through it. I mean, the big events are.
Yeah, I think the nice thing about the pacing is that because the life of the servants and the valets is one of constant scurrying around and getting things ready, the movie never gets boring, even though it's very slowly paced, because you're sort of always with the servants and they always have something very urgent to do. I love all the little shots of them, you know, taking these 2-second smoke breaks,
yeah,
where they can take like two drags off a cigarette and then they have to go about their business.
And Richard Grant has sort of one of the more visible but smaller. Is it just Grant or is it Richard E. Grant?
Which servant are you thinking of?
The guy who was smoking in the safe room, Richard E. Grant. And he sort of has a very visible role because, I mean, he was in Four Weddings.
See the one who spills coffee on Ryan Felipe after Ryan Felipe has been found out?
I don't think so. I think that was another guy. He's the guy who sneaks the cigarette. He's one of the four suspects that runs off to smoke a cigarette when the murder occurs.
Well, are any of the servants suspects? Because I think I remember Stephen Fry saying, like,
right, yeah,
well,
no, none of the...
I'm not even going to bother questioning the servants. And it's like, because basically they're not important enough to have committed a murder. They couldn't possibly have had a motive.
Yeah.
And that was one of those moments where I just thought, like, wow, it would be easy to get away with murder if you were a butler in those times.
And then he's got a good part in Derek Jacobi, who is, like, you know, pretty big as far as British actors go. I mean, he had a huge role in Hamlet. He had tons of BBC stuff, and he played Claudius and I, Claudius. He's kind of got this really small role as the victim's valet, and his role's small at the beginning and gets really big at the end after the murder, and the way Altman sort of introduces everybody so gradually, it's like he gets away with it. He gets away with changing the mix of how much screen time these people get at that point of the murder and the follow-up to it, that instead of having somebody who's barely spoken 10 lines, all of a sudden now gets some huge scene. Mm. And in some ways, I think it's one of Altman's, of all of his huge cast ones,
mm-hmm,
I think it's definitely, I'm trying to think if there's any other ones. I think it's definitely.
Well, I liked it more than Shortcuts, although that might be a little apples and oranges because that's so episodic. But I mean, this is episodic too in a way.
But I was going to say I like this more than Nashville. I think it succeeds more than Nashville does. Definitely more than Shortcuts. But my problems with Shortcuts are
legion.
No,
it's more comparable to Nashville for sure. Yeah.
And I mean, it's there's also that really great Patrick Doyle score that when I was watching it, there's sort of the big music at the beginning and during the opening credits, and then they get into the house and they're unpacking. This sort of music starts really quietly, and I pause the movie. I'm like, "Where's that music coming from?" Because it really did not. It was almost like synthesizer-y music. Just this one section. And I was shocked that it was in there, and it just works so well. but Doyle's really good too. So I'm trying to think if there's anything else. I mean, there's probably tons we've missed, but I mean, you kind of have to also, see it.
It's a big movie. Wasn't there kind of an odd similarity between the plot twist of who did the murders and our last episode, Psycho 2, in which the unseen mystery murderer is the mother of the well, in Psycho 2, it's someone who you know has been a murderer, and in this one, it's who the first murderer is revealed to be. But just the fact that it was the mother helping out the murderer kind of struck me
and
as an odd coincidence.
And there were two mothers in this one.
And there were two
just
mothers,
like
right?
In the last
right.
One. Well, sort of two mothers. Well, I mean, I guess if you counted...
sisters, yeah.
Just like the last... Well, that's creepy. And that's the other thing is how, you know, Altman does spend a lot of time going, hey, look at the poison over here. Ooh, poison. It's a murder mystery.
Right, right. And then there's a little postmodern repudiation of that where someone says, hey, there's poison all over the house, you know?
And they're collecting it and just carrying it off to do nothing with it. I mean, this investigation is just a joke. But then there's the hint of who the mother is. And just like in Psycho 2, it's not the mother you think it is.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure that that was...
And when she saw what they were trying to do to her poor little boy, well, one by one.
The mother knows.
Or just one.
Actually, in this one, it's not a mother knows. It's a good servant knows. I mean, it's just...
Yeah.
I cannot believe that this didn't... win more.
Well, they
did it win any
I guess,
acting actor? any acting Oscars?
I don't know. It's like who's the main actor, anyways?
Well, I mean, just like, for supporting cast, how? I mean, you know, if they wanted to be fun, they could have given to Maggie Smith because it's a great little role for her where she just plays this likable but terrible, terrible woman. Oh, look right. Who was nominated. Maggie Smith and Helen Mirren, the two people I was going to say should have been nominated for Best Supporting Actor. But yeah, no. Who won? What did you say? A Beautiful Mind won? Oh, yeah.
Best Picture, yeah.
And who won Best Director?
Probably Ron Howard.
Yeah, Ron Howard, man.
I guess the Academy correctly surmised that Robert Altman still had a few years left in him, and they could put off recognizing him a little longer.
Well, he never learned the Scorsese lesson, which is to make an incredibly commercial film, and then you will win. You will finally win your Academy Award.
Wasn't making a national public radio movie about the most commercial thing he could do at the time.
He died, right? I mean, he died.
Yeah, he died. He died like very shortly after winning awards at the Academies for that movie.
Yeah, but I don't think was that. I mean, I haven't seen it yet, but was it well received?
Yeah, it was well received. I haven't seen it either, but it was certainly well received.
It looks like he did a follow-up to his TV series, too. He did a sequel to Tanner 88, which
yeah,
was his TV
yeah.
series. So that probably took up some of his time. I mean, strangely, even though he's so memorable, he's not necessarily the most prolific guy. I mean, his 80s work, where he wasn't getting any recognition, was he did a lot more films then than he did in the 90s, even, after he sort of had his comeback.
Yeah. Well, we should watch Popeye sometime, which is his most commercial movie, and it was reviled at the time because people were dumb, and people have kind of come around to it now a little bit. Or if they aren't, we should help them because it's good. It deserves to be it deserves to be rediscovered.
We can do that with I don't know Batman Begins or something.
Yeah.
Now, okay. So speaking of non-prolific directors.
Uh-huh.
Our next film, from the prolific stage of his career, James Cameron's Piranha Part 2,
mm-hmm.
not 2, Part 2, spelled out twice,
yeah.
which was really stupid, The Spawning, which I think has the distinction of being the most boring
movie
killer
about
fish
killer
movie
fish.
Ever.
I was, yeah, I kind of remembered that it was boring from when I saw it a few years ago for the first time, but it's really kind of striking that, like, after the pre-credits deaths, there's no deaths for, like, a full half an hour, and then they start to pile on, like, an hour in. Like, because how hard would it have been to have taken those two girls who get naked on the boat? How hard would it have been to have moved their murder, you know, like 15 minutes in just to, I mean, like when Corman, like Joe Dante's story about, you know, working with Corman on Piranha 1 was that, like, you know, do it, he said, do whatever you want as long as there's a piranha attack every reel. So for, you know, for a cheesy sequel like this, you'd think that the Italian producers who bought the rights from Corman would have, you know, known to have had a piranha attack every reel, but
now,
no.
Okay, yeah. I want to talk about some of the behind-the-scenes stuff, and I guess we'll start with that. Is it actually... Did they actually buy the rights for a sequel? Because you can't trademark piranha, the word.
Well, they obviously did because, I mean, the movie goes so far as to reference the events of the first Piranha.
But vaguely, I mean...
Well, more so than if they had just, you know, I mean, there's plenty of sequels out there because the subject matter is something so generic as killer fish, where they don't even have to bother referencing, trying to tie it to the original movie at all. And not only do they vaguely reference the events of the first movie, but they reuse the the dentist drill sound effect to signify the piranha when they're underwater attacking people. That's exactly the same as first Piranha. James Cameron said he even called Dante on the phone to ask his advice before he started the movie, according to Dante. And I guess Dante's advice was, you know, make sure there's humor, which ended up as a lot of idiotic comic relief with the guests of this island resort.
I mean, just. I think this movie has, it's kind of like one of those USA Up All Night awful comedies, only James Cameron made it. Like, they have the Jewish girl going after the dentist, which I was just kind of like...
They have the two aforementioned hot girls, tricking this, I guess,
yeah,
retarded guy who works at the resort into giving them free food for the promise of a three-way and then ditching him on the dock.
That was funny. What else was really funny? Okay. Moving on to some others.
Oh,
but
yeah. Well, do you want to mention the comic relief around the main character's son and the fact that her ex-husband Lance Henriksen works as the security officer or police chief or whatever on the same island where they now live at the hotel for free? Because, like, wow, what a, you know, did she just have no chance of getting off this island with her son whatsoever? Like, after divorcing their dad?
We'll talk. Well, they're not divorced, I don't think, because it's sort of implied they're going to get back together at the end. But
I thought
they were still supposed to be married. I'll get to my whole thing with the mother and son after I try and unravel the.
Yeah. Okay. So there's USA Up All Night type comedic subplots.
Oh, no,
right?
I was actually going to talk about how all the rumors that Cameron actually didn't direct it.
Yeah. But, yeah. Supposedly, there's a story on IMDb trivia that he broke into some office late at night, cut his own version, and then the producer got Final Cut and cut together a very different movie. And then there's, like, another story that, like, Cameron only shot 10 minutes of it or something, and then the majority of it was shot by the producer. In fact, I'm looking at the IMDb page right now. The producer, Ovidio G. Asinitis, you don't want to catch that, has an uncredited directing credit. But you know what? Not only do I think that Cameron directed most, if not all, of the movie, because if he really didn't want his name on it, like, it could have been an Alan Smithy movie.
Right.
You know, it's not like if you don't get credit on your first movie, Piranha 2, it's such a huge deal. But yeah, not only did he not, you know, want his name taken off of it, but this time around, I'm convinced that H.A. Milton.
It's him.
It's got to be, because H.A. Milton, the screenwriter, has never had another credit. And the story contains, aside from the killer piranha, the story contains a ton of Cameron trademarks. Number one, the main character is a mother. Number two, Lance Henriksen has the most dignified part in it. number three, at the end of the movie, the main character and her friend are being chased through ducts. There's a duct system chase, just like Aliens. Number four, there's a whole bunch of underwater crap. And Cameron loves going underwater and shooting things underwater.
Yeah, I mean, it's, Wikipedia actually has that he wrote it.
Oh, and one of the piranha bursts out of somebody's chest, just like an Aliens or Alien.
Yeah, so I sort of went into it assuming that he had, just because I think I read the Wikipedia production history before I read the IMDb trivia, and there are some definite Cameron moments in it where you just are like, that feels like James Cameron. I don't know if it feels like Avatar or Titanic, but it certainly feels like, you know, Terminator or Aliens at times. And the thing about the that I've been giddy to get to is, back when Friends first started, I remember reading a review of it that the guy was like, I missed the first episode or something, and so like I watched three episodes before they mentioned that Courtney Cox and David Schwimmer were brother and sister, and it was really pervy when I found that out, because just of how close he gets to her and just, you know, their very physical relationship. That's what the mother and son are like in this. The kid throws a fish into his mother's bed while she's sleeping naked and then wrestles with her. And like, uh-huh. It's almost like he's gonna kiss her goodbye. Like she's like looking out.
Yeah, they get really, close, and it's exactly like he's hitting on her.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's just weird, and it's just kind of like this. You know, yeah. Obviously Cameron ought to make the movie where Sarah Connor and John Connor are running around, and you know, just it's spanking the monkey Terminator 4 or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like maybe the actors just weren't thinking about the fact that their characters are supposed to be mother and son, but come on, Cameron, do another take. Jeez.
Well, you kind of get the feeling this movie didn't have a lot of takes. I mean,
yeah.
There isn't a... I mean, Henriksen probably gives the movie's best performance, and even he's terrible. I mean, he's just... He's doing this Roy Scheider impression that...
Right, he's Roy Scheider.
He's Roy Scheider, only he gets... Well, I mean, the mother's...
He's even Roy Scheider in Jaws 2, where he's flying a helicopter around trying to get to his kids.
Except, of course, in Jaws 2, Roy Scheider doesn't, you know, man up and crash the helicopter to jump into the water.
I forgot about that. He has to get to his son and his girlfriend in the boat really quickly, so he jumps out of his chopper and lets it crash, and it's like... Wow, not only would that be endangering the characters' lives, but it completely endangered the actors' lives by crashing a real helicopter like 15 feet from them. So clearly pre-Twilight Zone, the movie.
Yeah. That's terrible, man. Oh, my God. But, I mean, the lead woman, I'm sitting there like, they could have gotten Adrienne Barbeau. Like, really? Like, she could act. This chick can't act. This is just terrible. I mean, she's, when we're saying she's the lead character, she's in it a lot. And she's the diving instructor at this terrible resort that has the gay manager who's out of a USA Up All Night resort movie. Basically, if you cut Piranha 2 and what's the name of the one with Johnny Depp and Rob Morrow? Private resort last
spring break or
something. They did a movie where they're in a resort. They should cut this and that movie together just to make a terrible, terrible thing. But I mean, it's because Hector Alonso could be running around while the piranhas are attacking people. But I mean, so she's awful. Her romantic interest is terrible. The kid's awful. I mean, the kid's weird, too. I mean, like, even when he's not hitting on his mom, the kid is weird.
Yeah, they have him disappear from the movie fairly quickly, and it really makes his character pointless, except to be, you know, rescued by his dad, Lance Henriksen, at the end of the movie.
And my favorite line in the movie might be something like when Lance Henriksen's like, when the wife's like, "You have to save him," and Lance Henriksen's like, "You know how I feel about him. Of course I will." And you're just kind of like, "What?"
Yeah, like, was it in doubt? Was it in doubt that he might not rescue his son because he hates his wife?
I'm just trying to think of. I mean, it's just like, it's such a.
Just talking about the ending a little bit. It makes no sense whatsoever. I mean, like, you know, in the first Piranha, the Piranha are not flying fish; they're actually relegated to the river. So the way they're going to kill all the piranha at the end is by polluting the bastards to death, in John Sayles' words. But in this one, the way they kill the piranha is by setting off explosives in the boat where the piranha eggs were being carried, and they crashed. And it's like, the piranha have already left that boat, man. Yeah. They've already flown onto the beach. So it's like, how do you even know they're – like, why would they all fly and then swim back to this
base.
Place and even if it's their base, but they never established that. And even if they had, like, how are they going to know that they've gotten all of them? Like, because remember Kevin McCarthy in the first Piranha saying, you know, as soon as they get into the water, they're going to breed like flies. It's like, well, yeah, I mean, they're all flying around out there now. They're loose. The genie's out of the bottle. You're fucked.
Thinking we approached Piranha 2 wrong. Because when you talk about, you know, their base and how they destroyed it at the end, it would have been a lot more amusing for the people who haven't seen it and never will if we actually made it sound like Piranha 2 was, you know, the source material for Aliens. That, like, after they destroyed the base, the Queen Piranha got onto the rescue boat. And they had they had to destroy the Queen Piranha with
And it was like bipedal, like humanoids from the deep or something, and it wanted to mate with Trisha O'Neill.
Something like that. Or with Lance Henriksen, I mean, you know.
Yeah. Or the creepy son's teenage girlfriend.
Yeah. It would have been most funny, however, if they wanted to mate with her idiot father, who was another scene of comic relief. Oh, the black guy! Oh, God. The poor black guy. There's like two black people on the whole island. It's Lance Henriksen's friend and his son.
Oh, and the nurse who gets eaten by piranha.
Okay, and forgot.
Who gets eaten by the piranha who pops out of the corpse's body and then flies out the window, shattering it.
They don't need to like, be in water anymore.
See that would have been the perfect time to establish that these things go back to their base at the ship.
Oh, you know, I bet they didn't have the budget for the helicopter shot of the piranha flying through the resort back to the base. They actually filmed this in the Cayman Islands, which I find shocking that they didn't actually film it in Italy. Because it's dubbed, just like Italian films of previous era where the actors just dub it in. But The introduction to the black guy is Lance Henriksen coming up and pretending he's going to, like, arrest him or something.
Right, because he's dynamite fishing.
He's dynamite fishing. And then, like, it's a big, ha ha ha, we've been friends for 20 years. Except there's no sign that the black guy's son has ever seen Lance Henriksen before. And you're just kind of like, ooh, well, I guess, you know, the son was never around. I guess I was a little surprised they kill the son like they do.
Yeah, that was pretty heartless. You know, it is mostly black people who get it in this movie because probably the best effects shot in the movie is where, like, some black resort worker walks out of the waters and he's all half eaten, and the makeup is actually pretty good and it's pretty disgusting. Yeah. And then just when you're into how disgusting it is, he keels over and is ridiculously yanked back into the water like he's on a zip line or something, like the piranha had him tied to a zip line because he just shoots back in.
Well, it's just like Terminator 2, you know, they kill the black guy in that too.
All right. But yeah, like the yeah, the Dynamite Fisher's son gets it, and then and then the Dynamite Fisher I want to say bravely sacrifices himself, except that he sacrifices himself for no reason whatsoever. Like, the piranha are attacking the beachgoers, and everybody has run inside to safety except for this guy who doesn't want to run inside to safety for some reason. He just stands outside, you know, swings his machete or whatever at the flying piranha, and then gets it for no reason. It's not even like he had to distract them long enough for everyone to get inside. Like, everyone is already inside.
He's fighting them for his son's honor. And then there are, like, these shots of Trish O'Neil, like, he's dying. Yeah. He doesn't have to die. And it's just like, oh, God. And you actually feel bad because the guy's not obnoxious. I mean, it's like, at the very end, she unfortunately lives in this kind of... I mean, that's kind of interesting how they're willing to abandon her and stuff.
Yeah, Lance Henriksen and his son are like, well, we're out of time. Sorry, honey.
So they leave, but she manages to catch the anchor or something.
Right.
And she
ride
lives,
it to safety.
Yes. So
yeah.
They go into their really strange and return to their really awkward family dynamic where...
Mm-hmm. They left out the last scene where Lance Henriksen and his son are banging her at the same time.
Sort of the inverse of what the guy in the kitchen did. Oh, they could have had the guy in the kitchen watching.
Wow. All right.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, it's really cheap jokes, and I can understand why Cameron wouldn't claim it, but, you know...
He didn't declaim it either.
Exactly. Well, I'm reading that he always, like...
Could have been written and directed by H.A. Milton.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I mean, this wasn't going to get Cameron any... He didn't get Terminator because of this, you know, it's like...
Yeah. Even though the piranha effects are probably the best thing in the movie.
Yeah.
I mean, aside from the fact that, like, when they attack people, it's somebody with an arm up a piranha puppet standing off screen and going for the neck. They always go for the neck. But, and you can see the wires when they're flying around, but, yeah, as far as the sculpt of the killer piranha themselves, they look pretty good. And actually, when they're swimming around, chasing the girl and the guy, and through the ducts at the end, it looks pretty good. So.
Well, actually, he says that Cameron has said that the trauma of making Piranha gave him a dream about the invincible robot hitman from the future, which catapulted him into writing the Terminator.
Hmm.
So anyway, I read something really funny that the guy who composed the music for Piranha was the only, you know, Cameron's movies are always either composed by Brad Fiedel or James Horner, and you know, Steve Powder wasn't one of them, and I was like, That's pretty interesting that they got an American to do this. No, they got an Italian and gave him an American name, so...
Yeah. First Piranha had good music by a good Italian composer, Pino Donaggio.
It's just, I mean, it's just really... I don't think we've ever watched anything for the podcast quite like this. I mean, this is... You know, it's astounding that Cameron ever had another directing credit, really, if you think about it. Based on this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is... It doesn't have the competence of a... Roger Corman movies are a million times more competent than this kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
So, is there anything else we haven't touched on? I think they ought to remake this, actually.
What, Piranha 3D isn't good enough for you?
No, Piranha actually, 3D what I... 2.
Oh, Piranha 2 3D.
Yeah, I mean, literally remake it only, you know, a funny flying fish movie.
Well, I would love if in Piranha 3D there's like a little surprise nod to Piranha 2 where one of the piranha sprouts wings and comes out at you in 3D. In fact, that would be a great twist ending.
Oh, it would be good. Now... When we say they're flying fish, they have wings. It's not like, you know, They don't have wings.
Yeah, they're bats, and they make bat noises. The flapping of their wings is the sound of a bat flying around.
They've been genetically altered to fly and be apparently live out of water and pretty much do everything else. There's a big long scene where they explain that with the most unbelievable marine biologist geneticist, you know.
Yeah. Well, what I love is that the guy who has been romancing Trish O'Neill the whole time, and then it turns out that he was doing that because he works for the government and is trying to. He knows about the piranha, but the really great thing about that revelation is that, like, it's the way that they tie it to the first movie, but Trisha O'Neill has already heard of the events of the first movie. Like, it was in the news that there were killer piranha out in Texas or wherever the first movie takes place at some point, and yet, like, she's the only one who knows about it. She's heard of Project Razor Teeth. And, you know, I remember some review saying that, like, it was by Bruce Kaywin or Kaylin, and it was a comparison between Toby Hooper's The Funhouse and Joe Dante's Piranha, or Joe Dante's The Howling. And talking about Joe Dante's Piranha, he says that, you know, the funny thing about it is that it shows that people who have seen Jaws, just because you've seen Jaws doesn't make you any more prepared to deal with not going into the water. But in Piranha 2, like, the main character has seen the first movie already, and it doesn't even occur to her. It takes her a long time to catch on to the idea that there's killer piranha out there. And then when this guy tells her that, you know, not only that, but they also bred the piranha with flying fish, she's like, come on, you gotta be joking. That would never happen.
Yeah, it's now Kid Brewer's in it somewhere.
Who's that?
He was in The Abyss at one point. In The Abyss, he's in it, so it's another Lance Henriksen connection. And actually, the topless girl was in Mannequin. Another one of our Alan Smithy podcast movies. Another connection.
Yeah.
But
was she topless in Mannequin?
No, Mannequin was PG. So.
Oh yeah. Well, she's pretty topless in this. So if you liked her in Mannequin, check out Piranha 2.
Yeah, the only person who's ever gonna leave a comment for us on iTunes is gonna be her telling us we suck.
You know, the scene where she and her friend get attacked by the flying piranha at night is it's pretty well done. I mean, it's about as well handled as you could do a scene where people are attacked by flying piranha.
Actually, I mean, some of the action sequences in this aren't bad. It's everything else. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like, you know, that was fine. It was you know, a competent low budget scene. It's trying to do the comedy. It's the creepy mother and son.
The bad comedy is, I mean, really what makes it a chore to sit through, especially between the pre-credits kill and when the movie starts picking up again. There's just a good long half hour where you're setting up all these unfunny hotel guests. That's really painful.
And I mean, Piranha 1 opened with the really good kill of the two people skinny dipping. And it's almost like Cameron tried to up the quotient with some underwater sex.
Which is absurd.
And, when they take off their oxygen masks to make out, I'm just kind of like, they're going to run out of air really quick. What are they going to do?
Right.
It's not like The Abyss, where they can go up to the top of the... that was in The Abyss, too. Don't they kiss to transfer air in the... You know, Piranha 2 is where it all started, man. We haven't seen Avatar and Titanic. Piranha 2 could totally be the blueprint. We have no idea. But yeah. So I don't know.
What else?
I really was expecting something more amusing, and I think I got
Well, I think it picks up in the last half hour.
Well, yeah.
I mean, also off the IMDb trivia, Cameron was quoted somewhere as like, you know, his humorous defense of the movie is, well, it gets a lot better with a six pack at a drive-in about halfway through. And it's like, that's only because nothing happens in the first half, dude. Like, of course it picks up in the second half.
We forgot the cougar, the...
Oh, yeah.
This is the difference between older women as sex symbols in the 80s and the 2000s is, you know, in this one, there's this hideous old woman who's trying to hit on the studly young guy, whereas,
right.
You know, now it's Ellen Barkin as the romantic interest for Matt Damon in Ocean's, was it 13 or something? I mean, it's like, it's changed quite a bit, but, and the four, I mean, it's just like, they keep going back to the joke, and they even miss the punchline. Like, that was the thing that I thought was so funny. So, the movie starts, we're meeting the guests, blah, 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 and so there's this guy who, I think he has a name, but I don't know. But he's basically this studly lifeguard type guy, and this old lady's hitting on this. I say old, she's probably about 45, right? Hitting on him. And, you know, he's like, no way, you know, sorry, ha ha ha, you're so sweet, blah, blah, blah. And he leaves, and she looks after him longingly. And later on, in the one moment I thought the movie was going to be funny, she's like bringing champagne to his room. And I'm like, oh, this is going to be funny. You know, he was hooking up with her the whole time. No, it's a whole mistake. So you have this awkward scene where the poor old lady is like, you know,
dejected
and leaving. And meanwhile, the guy's like hooking up with the...
Isn't it kind of strange how none of these guests who they set up get eaten by the piranha at the end? It's only like faceless nobodies who get eaten by the piranha. Well,
what about
except for that chunky guy who gets set up for 2 seconds as like, I'm gonna go run out ahead of everybody and cheat because I'm fat.
Yeah, and then we even forgot the married couple who are there, but they're on the C plan or something.
Oh right, the really cheap married couple.
Yeah, they're cheap, and it's just like, wow.
It would have been so much more satisfactory if, you know, after all these unfunny running jokes set up with all these people, they all got their necks bit by the piranha at the end. That would have been really satisfying, but no. Missed opportunity.
Yeah. What's so funny is one of the things I always liked about Cameron sort of growing up was he does so well with an ensemble cast and aliens. I mean, it's just like,
yeah,
not
movie either. This movie needed Bill Paxton. How can they fly, man? They're animals.
They're fish, man. They're just fish.
Right. He could have sold it. Concept.
Yeah, Bill Paxton's way too serious now. He could totally, you know, top line a Piranha 2 remake. Come on.
Mm-hmm.
Be great. He could play Lance Henriksen.
Yeah.
Okay, I think... see, I knew that was going to happen. I knew we were going to forget stuff about Gosford Park because it was so big, and I knew we were going to run out of Piranha 2 because, I mean, Cameron's not fun to make fun of. I mean, it's like, he's not like that, so we're not being mean-spirited about it. This isn't his fault.
Yeah, and this is probably the easiest movie of his to make fun of, bar none, except maybe Avatar. But that remains to be seen.
Yeah, so, and the other thing is, it's not in 3D, which I thought was really stupid because I assumed it was because they're flying Piranha. And if they're flying at the camera, they ought to be in 3D. And this was at the point that 3D was making its comeback.
Right.
You know, sort of culminating in 83.
Yeah, this was the year of coming at you.
So it would have been great. Or it would have been terrible, but at least it would have been in 3D. So, but anyway, from the director of Avatar. And I cannot believe no one, like, whoever issues this on DVD doesn't just do that every time. Like, from the director of Titanic. You know, make a pervy ass cover with the mother and son at the beginning. You know, from the director of Titanic, really small, Piranha 2, Part 2, The Spawning, or something. And they could do an Avatar type thing and tint everybody blue and shit like that. But no, instead, they don't. But yeah, so that's Piranha 2, Part 2, The Spawning.
Yeah.
I can't think of anything else. I think the music sucked, but I can't remember.
Yeah, the music's really overblown and sucky. Well, I don't know. How much more time do we owe this movie?
Actually, we like went over, so we're good. All right, over like 2 minutes. So.
Okay, well, I think that covers it then. our next episode is going to be another commentary track special, like the one we did for Halloween 2. This one's about a good movie, though, but it's Batman, the original Tim Burton 89 Batman, and we're going to have a lot to say about the Batman film franchise as a whole, I think, in addition to whatever kind of mixed praise we have for the movie. But it's going to be fun, so please join us for that. I guess that about does it. Check out our site, allensmithypodcast.info, for more information and past episodes. This has been an Alan Smithy podcast. I've been Matt.
And I've been Andrew.
And thanks for listening.
Love unchanging and true, I can give you the ocean, deep and tender devotion. I can give you the mountains, pools of shimmering blue. Music in spring, flowers for a king, all these I bring to you. When I was young, my foolish fancies used to make a great mistake. But now a little love, a little living, has changed my ways and taught me and brought me the joy of giving. I can give you the starlight, love unchanging and true. I can give you the ocean, deep and tender devotion. I can give you the mountains, pools of shimmering blue. Call and I can be all you ask of me. Music in spring, flowers for a king, all these I bring.